And a lot of times that of course doctors and physicians, they diagnose and they have very good methods of giving us, you know, somewhat a picture of what we might all encounter in our lives. But practitioners must believe the power of blessings, power of prayers, power of purification of karma. And that is why you go on retreat. Because if you did not believe in the possibility that you were all able to change your karma and have positive methods, then there would be no way we could have confidence to the possibility of obtaining enlightenment. And being able to liberate all sentient beings. How? Okay, I have to reduce the volume here because I keep hearing my voice and I have to wait until I finish saying something. So, can you hear me now?
Yes.
So, as I was saying, Buddhist path and the exertion of effort that we put into path for the exertion to be honest and to be wholehearted, there has to be a very strong confidence in being able to accomplish a state of realization which becomes the cause of liberation for oneself or sentient beings. So the aspirations that we make, sort of the result that we all aim for, is a state of enlightenment, freedom from suffering of samsara, not only of oneself but the others, and possibly of all the practices, mantra practices, reflect this essence most importantly. It emphasizes this point. And therefore, if we look at it from the perspective of what kind of a result we all believe in, then that also must encourage the meditator to knowing that you hold, you have the power to hold the result in your hand. Such a result would also entail purification of karma and acquiring or accomplishment of a tremendous amount of merit, which then in turn becomes the attainment of the result. So you have to have confidence in that. I think the Western practitioners, perhaps because even in the retreat over here I have been telling people, is the immense emphasis on intellectualization of Dharma, the view and adhering, I think that sort of swinging that we're doing between believing the view or having difficulties believing the view. So we swing between these two extremes and spend a lot of time doing that. And that process of trying to have confidence in the view, analyze the view, maintain the view, takes so much time that it stays in the level of intellectual understanding. That's how the predominance of the theory happens, and actualization of the practice takes a backseat. So maybe because of that, the modern day meditators tend to probably encounter and be overwhelmed by obstacles very quickly. And they may believe the power of prayers, power of purification of karma, power of even the result of Buddhahood. But when you do encounter difficulties such as diseases, when you encounter obstacles, obstacles to yourself or obstacles around yourself, to your friends and family members and so forth, it's so very easy to be shaken up by that experience that it almost seems like here you believe samsara and samsaric symptoms to be more powerful than the power of your practice, power of your meditation, power of your understanding of the meaning of Dharma. So it's very crucial that as we encounter different stages of life, and of course, we see all pain and suffering and different kinds of obstacles in ourselves and in the lives of the others, to use that moment as even greater encouragement and inspiration and reminder to practice the Dharma even more. And so the possibility of doing retreat is wonderful. I'm very, very delighted that all of you are at Lotus Garden in such a large number and spending time in practicing. When we first hoped that there would be a series of retreats at Lotus Garden, and I hope that this is an ongoing thing, and I hope that people don't think that this is the only time that you're going to do it this year and then next year something else is going to happen. Lotus Garden was intended to be a retreat land, and that if there was deepening of the practice and spending more time, and I've kind of given up hope when we're being there for life, but even these 4 days and 5 days, all of you staying together and practicing, this is, you know, very, very wonderful. And as I was saying earlier, when we sort of suggested, I remember sitting with some of our Lopins and discussing this about, you know, 5 or 7 of the retreats through the winter and going into spring, there was a kind of skepticism or frown in their faces. We don't know whether so many people will come and do all these retreats. At one point, Barbara was saying, well, you know, it depends on the attendance. Maybe 3 will show up, maybe 10 will show up, one never knows. But it has been consistently strong in attendance, and the wonderful opens and even the great amount of dedication that the residents have shown in being able to create this space. And then I know in the back there have been our senior practitioners, which is Mark and Jesse, or Andre and Kathy, or Judy, or all our opens, and of course some of the other seniors also, who have supported this and contained it and have encouraged people to dedicate themselves to practice. And I think it's wonderful that you're all doing this. I don't know the sort of point of doing this kind of talk, because you have wonderful opens there who are teaching very, very well and helping the students. And I think sometimes you hear more from them clearly than you hear from me. So normally I sit down and I think of all the things that I say. I don't know how much you all actually listen or hear. Maybe 2% or maybe 3%, or some maybe a little bit more than that. But either you're terrified or you're sort of, I don't know, you catch one point and then you hang on to one point, and I don't think you all go beyond that one point most of the time. So the caring and the love and the genuine friendliness and sort of comfortable relationship that you have with our locals and with our senior teachers, that I think has been tremendously helpful for our students in understanding the Dharma and practicing the Dharma. And you all matured as practitioners. You all become really, really, I think, trusted students of the Dharma, capable of holding now the contents of the precious teachings, and become someone to whom I can no longer sort of say, keep saying, you're doing it only in theory or intellectually, because many of you are very much working with yourselves. And so that's all very nice. We have over 100 retreatants during this 15 days of retreat here in India, people from about 18 different countries. So it's very interesting to see the kind of mixture of different nationalities practicing. And at the same time, it's also very sort of interesting to see how much sameness is there, whether this is a practitioner from Switzerland, or whether it's a practitioner from Poland, or from Canada, or from America. There's all the similarities, and yet the uniqueness of every country and culture that they come from. The sameness, however, I find is perhaps in the somewhat, I wouldn't say lacking, but somewhat a different understanding of what it might mean to be in retreat. Because they've traveled, now to give an example, they've traveled from different places already to come to a monastic setting and have intensive practice sessions. But at the same time, they want to shop, they want to see different things, they want to take things. They want to particularly make sure they all get all the alcohol and So this is MA tumor, which has been a very big thing for the women. It makes them stupid and dressed. On the other hand, they are all very sincere, just as you are all very sincere and dedicated to trying to, you know, devote time, intensive time to practices. They are just as sincere. But it brought to my notice about what it might mean to be in retreat. Because I find that very often retreat seems to be so much dominated by your wish to finish with the technicalities of the practice, to do more numbers than you would otherwise be able to do, to have more hours to doing your formal practices, to study more, and probably sort of devote more concentration to the practices and to the meditation. This is very good. On the other hand, if it doesn't, however, also emphasize the action part, your body and how you behave with your body, your speech and how you use that speech, and particularly analyzing or observing, keeping a very watchful eye on the thought process, how you generate emotions, how you relate to sensations, how you interpret feelings, how you act on those feelings and emotions. If you don't keep a very mindful observation on these, then what happens is your good intent to practice more may sometimes become very neurotic. Mm-hmm. And so that neurosis often will bring about a sort of deliberateness even to the technicalities of the practice. So we get into this very strange dilemma where you know the view and yet you may not be doing the view. Where you may be meditating, but you're not meditating simultaneously. It's a very difficult thing to explain, but if one just keeps sort of a watch on one's own self, you'll find out. And there is a good part of you, and then there is also that selfish part of yourself. And you're always trying to overlap one with the other. And you spend a lot of time doing that. So retreat has to be a place where you break free from everything that you are used to being, sort of used to allowing to being very powerful in your mundane life. Because with humility, a practitioner thinks, no matter how much dedication I bring to my power of practice, I humbly accept the fact that samsara is very powerful. And the distractions that they are. Careful situation. So strong. Hello? Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes,
ma'am. Okay. All right. Well, I think we can give Vinod and Andre the responsibility to wave to me if he's not hearing me clearly. And so the thing, when either our own habitual patterns are strong, or certain situations, environmental responsibilities, or relationship responsibilities, they become very powerful. They demand. And the demand is so very powerful that we can't refuse to responding to them. So when we accept it with the humility, the immense powerful of samsara, because of which our own understanding of Dharma and the aspiration to sincerely practice the Dharma becomes or encounters obstacles, then in that situation, today we put it to give a That was one of our senior managers waving to me from the door outside. They need to sign checks. When we come to accept the fact that this is, you know, we have to wish to develop non-attachment and to concentrate on the good of nature and so forth, but situations in samsara are like that. So when a practitioner goes into retreat, he or she generates a strong intention to almost physically pluck yourself from that situation to bring you into a situation which would be very conducive to the path of service. But only physically picking yourself up from the hope that putting them in the retreat doesn't help. Why, when you physically come to a retreat, you have to have the motivation and the intention to then discard or let go of habitual ways of thinking. Physically, you have to abstain from those actions that are and have the traces of the conditions, whether it is aggressive physical movement, whether it is physically being very strong, including in desire or attachment or grasping, whether it is physical pleasures, which may be as simple things as the extra comfort of soft bedding, let's say, or physically where you might be sitting. Also, being very watchful to the neurosis, the klesha of desire, klesha of attachment, physical attachment arising. In the same way, ignorance and laziness, distractions, whether it is inner absorption or outer distractions, jealousy, and at the same time, arrogance. In the same way, all of these traces of these klesas must be checked, whether or not they are there in our speech. And of course, mind, which is very important. So, being or coming into a retreat is now you have to break and produce strong, powerful intention and determination to break free from that kind of a habitual, samsaric way of behaving, speaking, thinking, and coming into an environment when that person is not only seeking in the Dhamma practice, but in the you embody a Dhamma, where you embody the
you're breaking up just a little bit there, again.
Okay, now can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Are we back on track?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, where you embody as to use a word, a culture of Dhamma. So, you live like a Dhamma practitioner because the environment created did that. You speak with more thoughtfulness and maintaining the discipline. And you keep your mind clean. I won't even use the term pure. You keep your mind clean. Clean from the negativities which other than your habitual intent to keep them, there is no need to nurture them, at least for the duration of the practice retreat. So a whole change and breaking free from the samsaric patterns must be cultivated during the retreat. Now you're closer to the retreat, but as you go into further retreats, you have to keep that in mind, whether you're doing it at home, whether you are doing it in a group, whether you are doing a solitary retreat, wherever it may be. And as soon as you say, I am in retreat, then you have to know, what are you retreating for? You are retreating from habitual patterns. You are retreating from samsara and engaging in cutting ties with the root causes that bring confusion, ignorance, suffering to oneself and to the others. So this is a very important aspect that people must engage in, which then although refuge, when you take refuge, for example, you take refuge from samsara, and the usual habits of surrendering to samsara and the causes of samsara, you shift that to taking refuge into Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha. And Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha is nothing but imparting or emphasizing the essence, the pure essence of one's own awakened nature. Buddha is the awakened nature, your awakened nature. Dhamma is the sound of that awakened nature. The expressivity or the quality of expressivity of the awakened nature is and Sangha, the ability to allow that expressivity to manifest through your body, speech, and mind. So this way of looking at it is allowing the essence of both the outer refuge of the outer Buddha Dhamma, Sangha, and the inner refuge of the inner Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha, one's own Buddha nature, to be realized. And so, when you take refuge, there has to be, in the course of your session, sincere moments where instead of surrendering to samsara, you surrender to your own awakened nature. And that you have to do it with humility. The prostration part is the humility. It constantly should remind you of the humility of being united and abiding inseparably with one's own awakened nature. Because meditators have to keep reminding yourself that the ego can be tricky. And even a brilliant moment of calmly united, remaining united with one's own basic nature, fundamental nature, could easily be manipulated by the ego to becoming either self-absorption or self-importance. So, humbly be calm, with humility remaining wakeful. That humility is further enhanced by bodhicitta. And I believe Logan Andre gave an example of the mother's breast milk that naturally flows when she gives birth to a child. And I think that's a beautiful expression, beautiful analogy to keep in mind, is that when you give birth to bodhicitta, then the expression of that bodhicitta, the selfless kindness, should be as nurturing and as natural as a mother's milk to her child. So that's very, very wonderful example, keeping that in mind. The awakenedness, the abiding within the awakened nature of your intrinsic Buddha mind, or the enlightened mind. The expressivity, as we talked about, has to be gentle, it has to be kind. Now, beyond all the beautiful words that we use, what does refuge and bodhicitta mean? Is that you are quiet, intrinsically quiet, calm, wakeful, generous, and gentle to yourself, to the others. And in that gentleness, there is a very sharp or a brilliant awareness of your environment. When all of these qualities are embraced by suppleness, pliancy, or flexibility, then you really understand the meaning of the first stage of mandala, inner mandala, the refuge and the bodhicitta practices. So the rigorous practices of refuge, bodhicitta, and frustrations should sort of like tanning the leather, as we say in Tibetan, should make the body, speech, mind of the meditator nothing but gentle, supple, wakeful, and genuinely gentle and kind to oneself and in our environment. So perfect, sort of arhat, a perfect bodhisattva should come out from the session of refuge, bodhicitta, and the prostrations. But that meditator never lets go of the humility of knowing the power of karma and the lacking of merit that we all have. And this is particular to the lay practitioners. In today's times, of course, monks and nuns have their share of challenges. That's one of the stories. You are all lay practitioners. And lay practitioners, how can you forget that you live in the thick of samsara? And just being fathers and mothers and husbands and wives and sisters and brothers and mothers and sons itself is enough reason for you to know how easily karma is created continuously, and reflecting upon the power of karma and the power of its manifestation, the impact of its manifestation. And then the busyness of being driven by karma that doesn't give us much opportunity to accumulate merit. And so where a meditator tries to remain awakened, supple, and kind, the humility also has to be there in the wisdom, in the knowledge that karma doesn't allow that good quality of refuge and bodhicitta to manifest unimpeded. And encountering positive circumstances are also very difficult because they must lack in merit. You have to have a very practical and a honest approach to really looking at your, you know, sort of storage of and how far you have accomplished. And in that regard, do not become sort of a poet at that and come up with beautiful words. Now, Love and Helen, for example, now, might immediately come up with this beautiful poetic expression of, you know, my karma and my marriage. And she might throw different colors in that. And sometimes, you know, I'm just taking it as an example. But I like doing that because I like seeing Helen do that. But, you know, we lose our ground in different kinds of abstractness. And we may have some sense of awareness of the power of karma or the merit as I was speaking, but we easily evade that issue and come up with different rhetorics and different kinds of explanations. And the depth of what we are trying to find takes us very often. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Good. You have to have a very practical attitude, straightforward, down to a practical attitude regarding karma and merit. And that is, you have to sit up and look at how many karmas do you accumulate each day, and how many of it do you actually purify? And if not purifying, at least how much do you remind yourself? How much do you actually sense they can? You're just, what are you trying to tell me?
Oh, we can't hear you.
Ken? Oh. So Ken was waving from behind, so I wondered if you
know. No, I was just thinking about what you were saying and said, oh my God. it was just an expression of, oh my God. Oh my Rinpoche.
So, in that very practical and straightforward approach that you will bring, you have to see how much you are actually reminding yourself of the karma that you have accumulated. And nobody is going to, you know, be accountable for that other than your own self. This is what you would experience, the result of that karma you would experience in life. And this is what you would take into death and every experience after that. And then in the same way, merit each day, do you mindfully exert enough effort to acquiring merit, to building up merit, engaging in meritorious actions of body, speech, and mind. Now, when a meditator reflects upon this, and as I said, as a lay practitioner, when you reflect upon this, one is humbled by seeing how continuously we create endless, seamless karma, innumerable karma, and how lacking we are in merit. Of course, accidentally, we may have an opportunity to accumulate merit sometimes. Sometimes, as practitioners, we do try to make a conscious effort to, you know, be meritorious. Every time I speak about merit, oftentimes what happens is people make a check and make a donation to one of the charitable projects, and then sort of you're done with it, which expects you to make a donation to a charitable project. That's the, you know, meritorious activity I've done. And then you do not concentrate on that for the next, you know, time until you hear another talk on merit. That's not how you accumulate merit. Merit has to be the appearance and the manifestation of the six paramitas in every aspect of your life, wherever you are, in whatever environment you are in, and whatever activity you may be doing. When merit is being accomplished and one realizes the importance of accumulating merit and one sees the karma and the power of karma, then a meditator has the humility of knowing how much one needs to train oneself so that the refuge and bodhicitta's result, the awakened kindness, is further enhanced and supported. And one of the main things we all find is we have given ourselves very little time to becoming familiar with a heart that is always kind, always awakened, and always flexible. Vajrasattva practice allows us to give ourselves an opportunity to do or bring two things. One, familiarize with the awakened nature, which is pure and does not need the pleasures to actually survive or to do something good for oneself and the others. So Vajrasattva practice allows us to becoming confident of the awakened nature and less reliant upon the pleasures which our ego is trying to convince us is necessary for surviving in samsara. So that's why our great teachers, they not only survive, but then they manifest such boundless activity that sustains the lives of thousands of others. Now, ourselves, if we look at ourselves, fathers or mothers or, you know, husbands and wives of a family, just to pay mortgage, pay the monthly bills, just to live life, how hard do you have to work? You spend your entire life working hard, and yet, you know, the struggle is always there. The fear of making it year after year always remains there. In comparison, these teachers not only seemingly sort of survive very beautifully in this world, but then they create this wealth, they create this magnificent environment where hundreds of people can actually, without any concerns, without any worries, live and sustain a life of practice. That happens not because of miracles. That happens because they are confident of their pure nature to such a point that they do not rely upon samsara and patience to live life or to be able to manifest anything in samsara. As meditators, you have to sometimes think about this and recognize, well, if teachers can do it, What have they done? What have these great masters done to be able to accomplish this? And then you find it, their karma, they're purified. They're not creating negative karma. And in the same way, their merit is continuously engaging in activities that are nothing but meritorious. And in doing so, they have no fear in breaking free from samsaric pictures because they trust their awakened nature so much more. And that trust has been supported by formal practice. Now, therefore, Vajrasattva, when you do the mantra recitation of Vajrasattva, then, you know, just as the Amrita flows from the pum syllable, that is at the navel of the five-pronged Vajra, around which the mantra garland is rotating. So the garland, mantra garland, rotates, and the rotation itself creates an energy or some powerful force that sort of overflows in the form of Amrita. And from the navel of the Vajra, which is held at part of Vajrasattva, Amrita flows up. Why are you all of your Pum? Why are you? There has to be a force of aspiration.
You were breaking
okay,
up a little.
Now, can you hear me now?
Yes, Ram Chair.
Okay. Every time there are those sound gaps, I can hear a whirring sound, then we just wait and finish it and then we'll continue. Okay?
Okay, I'll stop waving.
Oh, hey, I like it. So, rotation of the mantra garland. Now, there is some kind of, you know, it's not necessarily a symbolic analogy, but at the same time, it could be taken as is to gain the inspiration of force. And the force being the force of aspiration. Aspiration to be free from the overwhelming, empowering quality of karma, and the strong force of the aspiration to have virtue at one's own heart. And so the rotation of the mantra is more like the sort of stringent emphasis of one's power of aspiration. So whether it is the power of devotion, power of diligence, power of genuine effort or exertion of effort, the power of genuinely wishing to realize the cessation of the cause of suffering of all sentient beings. That power, the forceful power, so in Tibetan we say Tenbe, or the power of aspiration. When that is strong enough, then it is able to bring about purification. Now think about it in this way. In that whole process of the Vajrasattva's Dhiti or Amrita being sort of forced, enforced by the swirling mantra garland, what are you as a meditator doing at that is generating such a powerful, strong wish to really give more naturalness and inseparable awakeness, inseparably abiding within the awakened nature that we talked about in the context of refuge and bodhicitta. Now, to be able to exude or generate such a powerful intention, powerful aspiration, you would have to really have strong emotion and understanding of the negative tendencies, the negative consequences of unvirtuous actions, and a powerful understanding of the profound quality and value of virtuous actions. That's the whole point. After a retreat or after the accomplishment of the practice, after the accomplishment of the practices of Vajrasattva, for example. Okay, now can you hear?
Yes.
come from this should be a strong, natural distaste for habitual neurosis and a much more genuine wish to nurture those actions that are the expressive qualities of bodhicitta, which is merit. So purification of karma really means you develop distaste or allow distaste for karma over to this. If I'm here, but I'm not speaking.
What?
Hi, gentlemen.
So, and to be free from the, you know, sort of belief that we need to depend upon these kleshas for survival in samsara. Now, when the mind is freed from this sort of capturing grasp of samsaric habitual patterns, then naturally, of course, the mind has more awakened quality of merit. And merit is nothing but being able to express the aspiration bodhicitta in engaged bodhicitta. So that is then how engaging in practice bodhicitta should result from the creation of oneself.
Breaking up.
So after accomplishing the result must arise from it is a meditator who realizes. And so when, now imagine when you do Vajrasattva more and more and you then find your mind really trusting, you could refrain from habitual neurosis and yet make it through samsara, and that confidence enables you to keep pure heart and pure intent and engage in pure action, then meritorious, virtuous conduct is the natural expression. This is the way you bring the resultant state of your bodhisattva body. You not only think bodhicitta, but now you are able to engage in bodhicitta. And as a bodhisattva traversing the path towards Buddhahood, what do you think that bodhisattva does? To use a very sort of another analogy, what does a career of a bodhisattva look like? So the career of a bodhisattva is someone who has not only bodhicitta in intent, but also has bodhicitta in action, and then gently progresses to the path of Buddhahood. So the whole purpose of the first two stages of the mundra practices should be seen that way. But at the same time, remember, it's still, all of this still will remain more in aspiration than reality. Because we have been in samsara for a very long time. And therefore, for the aspiration to accomplish this and to actually make it fruition, you will need two things. You will need to really work with lessening self-grasping, and you will need to have a genuine support of all the practices that arise from the wisdom of the gurus and the teachings. The latter two segments of the mundra practices, mandala practice. Mandala practice is that part of the mundra which best enhances the reminding quality in the mind of a meditator that what you are doing must never be manipulated by the ego mind to making it into self-absorption. and therefore self-absorption will come. That is where, again and again, meditators, even those of you who go into retreat, will never realize how easily the ego steps in, manipulates the whole you, and makes you so sort of trapped in self-importance and self-absorption. Almost, isolate yourself retreat. And imagine that the retreat is some kind of an ambitious project that you are engaged in. And so, meditators must be very acutely aware of this distortion that the ego will bring in, is that you will never realize how easily the ego makes bodhicitta into an ambitious project, makes silence into an ambitious project, make your, half an hour session even into an ambitious project, make Buddhahood and realization of basic nature even into a greater ambitious project. And so, watch out for that. The antidote to that is selflessness, lessening self-grasping, lessening self-absorption, and lessening the demands of all of those paraphernalia that we demand from the external world to sustain self-importance. So generosity is always the most integral essence of Madhava, and you make vast offerings and you give away the sun and the moon, and in that form you try to give away all the things that you can think of that are most excellent and best to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Why do you do this? You do it to knowing that self-grasping mind, stingy mind, is not needed. Certain fearlessness of lessening self-grasping has to arise in the mind of the meditator. I need a good teacher, I need good teachings, I need good retreat places, I need time, I need understanding from the others, I need all my practice liturgies, I need somebody to show me how to do these practices, I need guidance, I need my answers, I need to have good questions first and then I keep answering. There are things that we make our leave our very before we can activate. Before, there are all these many different things that we believe are important, which we think will only then bring about the possibility of lessening self-grasping and being free from self-absorption. If you're always afraid that you need everything to be given to you, all your demands need to be met, and only then you are going to be able to practice your faithful. If at the start you have very little, then giving up will be very much more easier. Keep that in mind. So, now after refuge and bodhicitta and prostration, after Vajrasattva, Mandala is the time where Vajrayana meditators more or less are now beginning to engage in the actual practice and view of Vajrayana. So you have to have the quality of being a suitable vessel in which Vajrayana has to be used. And the suitable quality is the manifestation of fearlessness and gentle calmness. But restlessness and mind that is always very weak and lacking in confidence will always be the traits of somebody who is very much in love for you. Greater self-absorption, more lacking in courage. The greater arrogance, weaker in confidence. So all these negative tendencies of arrogance, jealousy, demanding and selfishness are all cover-ups of actually a very weak mind. and the weakness is because of the immense attachment to the self. So mandala, when you practice mandala, encourage yourself to knowing that you do not need things, you do not need concepts, you do not need those things that are conjured by a very active mind to actually sustain the confidence of remaining immovable, inseparable from your own awakened nature. Give up the moon, give up the continents, give up your home, give up your families, give up all material wealth, give up even the worries about your future. Why would you need them anyway? Now, giving up doesn't mean throw them away. That's not what we're saying. But there's an attachment that you can do without. Even without a self-grasping attachment to your family, you can fulfill your responsibilities. You can be a good father. You do not need to carry the self-importance and self-grasping in order to be a good father. You can be a wealthy person without the attachment to the wealth. So whether you are endowed with many people, relations, or wealth or not, should be the same for a Vajrayana meditation. Because as a Vajrayana meditator, you trust the awakened nature more than every other thing that surrounds it. And for that understanding, we need the support of the teachings. And as the teachings say, teachings would never be possible without the enormous kindness of all our masters, of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. Guru devotion and Guru yoga dispels the arrogance of imagining one doesn't need support on the path of practice. It also gives us an enormous support in knowing whom to emulate and whose example to follow. And it enriches the mind with the wisdom and experiences of all. Now, if you think of four reminders and you with the cultivation of the essence of all the four aspects of the mandala, the inner mandala. Then imagine what kind of a beautiful, jewel-like, awakened mind would arise. To such a point that after mandala you may not need to do anything else. And therefore, recognize the importance of mandala and the wonderful opportunity that you have to practice in it. It should never be regarded as a time and number dominated practice. Again and again, I remind you, you have for one life, this precious human existence, to practice the Dharma, bring it to fruition, and you can bring it to fruition with the wonderful eight aspects of the outer and inner mandala practices. If this is all that you can do in life, there would not be the need to do anything. Somebody who thinks you can do it in 2 months. Of course you can do one and finish it with it in 2 months, but make sure after that you have no more karma and no more, you know, nothing more to do in terms of merit, and your awakened nature is indivisibly awake and supple and flexible and expressing and nothing but genuine kindness to the others. You may do it just in 5 days. And I'll be very happy. We have some people think they can do it with 100,000. So some people think they can do it in 100 days, and that's also very good. Many of us think we need to do it again and again throughout our lives because the power of, you know, all our habitual tendencies are so very strong. And so it is up to each one of you to develop this heart connection to the practice. Give less importance to what others have said how this practice should have done. The guidance is always very well-meant and therefore essential. But no one knows the degree of how stubborn your karmic habitual tendencies may be than yourself. So make that decision for yourself. Nobody knows how aware you are and how much you have been able to accumulate merit. Make decision on how your practice of mantra should be based upon that. Nobody knows what would be the things that would best enhance the awakened mind and your ability to remain inseparable from it than yourself. Do the mantra practices in order to bring that about. How much you need to do, how often you need to do, that's up to you, basically, because eventually this is your path of practice and you should be responsible for it and no one else. That also which mantra to do, this mantra, that mantra, how should these two be integrated? Should both be done? Should one be done? I've answered that question many times. There is no difference in any mantras, long or short, however it may be done. Most oftentimes, the only reason you will end up with many different kinds of mantra liturgies is because you keep asking teachers questions. And the result of it is then being sort of giving you to do. What should I? You know, somebody had the wise moment to ask after Gomba Sampal, what should we do as a Samaya practice? As if all the Samayas that you had were already done, you know, and so you needed something more. Out of kindness of the great teacher, you did get the Gomba Sampal's short mantra that was given to you. Because you took the empowerment, you should do it. You should do it either during the retreat individually or at some point in your life. And if you see that as the main mantra that you will do for your mantra practices, you can do that. But many of you that I know have already been doing something else or have been doing something else, then I think you should continue with whatever you have been doing. And as a Samaya, keep in mind that you should do it at some point, or now you're integrating it into your retreat, then that's very good, and that's then done with. There was a question about these two. Judy, you had a question about this? Did you?
Rinpoche, there was a question that came up just about how, I think you just answered it, what the relationship between the Gompa Zantal Mundro and People's Foundational Mundro was, but I think you just answered it.
Everything doesn't have some relationship with it.
I'm sorry?
You know, not only about wonder, but I keep hearing this, what's the relationship between this and that? You know, everything doesn't need a relationship. The Gomba Sampal Mantra is the cousin of the artist of the moon. So, if your life is long enough, try to do all of them. If you are at a stage in your life where you have less time, or you feel you have less time, concentrate on what you are holding in this moment. Always appreciate what you're holding at this moment as a practice. Make that good. If with the blessings of the Buddha, if your life is long, you will always have possibilities to do others or many more other practices. There is no harm in keeping the aspiration. What you can do, do that. And do that wholeheartedly as it has been taught. And then the fruition will come. It shouldn't be like monkeys who hold, you know, this is the spring, beginning of the spring, and Mayumla, my mother, our mother, has fruit trees around the residence. And we have many monkeys here these days. So every morning, what I find is monkeys trying to get fruits from the trees that she has around. And it's very sweet to watch. They have both hands. And then they stuff their mouths and then they try to run, you know, in a minute. So sometimes I think that's how we practitioners work. We're on the bed, we're on the teeth, you know, trying to practice bodhicitta and so sometimes the monkeys, when they are chased, then because they have everything being held in their hands and mouth, they have nothing to hold on to when they jump from one place to another, and then they fall. That might be the result. Okay, so that's much for today. Anything else? Any questions? Very nice group, no questions. All accomplished. I hope you all keep well. Thank you all for practicing. Thank you particularly to Lopan Andre, Lopan Helen, and Judy Wolfer, who's been very kind in helping so many of the students, Jesse Munn and Mark Beckstrom, as well as Kathy. All of you, there are so many of you. And to Lisa and Lori and Chris, as well as the other residents who, despite the limited number of staff, still managed to host this wonderful program here. But I know that many of you, I spoke with Lisa earlier, and she said many people have been stepping up to help, and that's really very nice. You should not see your coming to Lotus Garden as coming to a center, Dharma center, to practice retreat. You are coming to your own homes. However, a home that is not particularly, should be kept as a samsaric home, but a Dharma home, a place where you can really be true to your intention to practice. There has to be flexibility and ease with how you relate to the land and to the teachers and to the practice part here, so that as you come more and more in practice, you have less and less pretentiousness to bring, less and less deliberateness to bring, less and less formalities and protocols to bring, but that you can come with a pure intention to practice, and the whole environment reverberates with the power, the blessing, and the energy of practice and practitioners. I think it has been done with the efforts of many people. I appreciate that very much, and I hope that it is continuous. And until I see you again, everyone, take care of yourselves, take care of one another, guide each other on the path of the practice. Point out the neurosis, and more importantly, when someone does, appreciate that and learn to take it in good spirit. Elders should nourish and nurture and care for the younger ones. And the younger ones, in age and in experience, always respect the older students and older Dhamma practitioners. When there is mutual love and mutual respect among all of you, you will have a healthy Sangha. And when the Sangha is healthy and harmonious, it simply brings the blessings of all the Buddhists and Bodhisattvas, and that can only dispel more obstacles and make your practice more strong and less hindered by outer circumstances. Okay? Well, thank you all very much. Chris, thank you for making it possible. And Jatsangar.